Good afternoon. Yes, now with the mic unmuted. Okay. So last time we talked a bit about sort of overall themes we're going to see in this class. We have a variety of hardware and low-level software topics, some logistics stuff, and then we started talking a bit about building programs. And one thing we talked about was static versus dynamic linking. So we mentioned that when we make an executable, we've learned before that, oh, we can take these object files, which are kind of a binary representation of assembly files, and combine them together into an executable. Often we also have sort of routines, for example, like the C standard library, printf, and things like that, that we also want to use that sort of haven't pre-built. And there's kind of two ways that these can be packaged for us to include in our executable. And one way is this idea called dynamic linking, where rather than including a copy of printf in every program we make that uses the library containing printf, we'll have all these programs will load that at runtime. Sort of when they start, they're going to look for a file containing it on Linux, typically something called libc.so, and they'll load that. And an advantage of this as well, you know, we have less copies of printf's code in our disk. We can upgrade that copy of printf to make fix a bug or something, and all the programs will get it. Disadvantage is that, well, you know, now, you know, if we move our program over to a system with a different copy of that library, it's going to behave differently. And it's probably a little more complicated to load. So we also have an alternative approach called static linking, where instead we include the copy of that printf code in the executable. And on Linux, our dynamic linking libraries sort of have the extension .so and have to be in a place we can find them when our application starts. Our static linking libraries conventionally have the extension .a and are actually just archives of .o files that the linker looks at, just kind of as a shorthand for rather than us listing in our command line every single .o file in the standard library, we can just list this archive that's kind of like a zip file of all of that. Then we started talking about sort of steps to build applications and libraries. And that's what we're going to pick up today, and also talk about some automation for that. So questions about things we covered last time before I move on? Yes?
Sorry, how do you pronounce your last name?
How do I pronounce my last name? Rice. It rhymes with the more common last name, W-I-E-I-S-S, Vice, which might help remember that. Okay, so before I talk about some sort of building applications, one thing on logistics. So some people said, gosh, it's kind of weird that, you know, if you want to put together your lab submission after lab, you didn't get the checkoff. You know, that's 11:59. I didn't like really think hard when choosing that time. I just copied what I did in other courses. So I moved it to 8:59 the next day because I don't care about that difference. And it might mitigate some complaints. Our hope is that you can do the lab in lab time and it's not an issue. That, of course, might not work out entirely. I don't want to move it much past the morning of the next day, because I don't want whoever's running like their 9 a.m. office hours to end up running a substitute lab but with only one TA. That seems like a bad time for them and a bad time for the people who go there. Okay, so that's on logistics. So last time we finished up on this sort of exercise here. So here I have a program, main.c, that is built, program, that's built from main.c and extra.c, and we also have an extra.h. So we can think of, we have main.c, extra.c, and we also have an extra.h. And when we're building this, the process is we make a main.o and an extra dot O that is built from the one of the C files and extra dot H, because they both include that. And then we combine these into a file called program. And also, sort of not pictured here, is that we also combine that with the C library in some way, depending on, in this case, probably using dynamic linking. So the program will be set up to load the C library when it runs for standard IO of H, which is one of the system header files. And if, let's say, we change main.c, question is, what commands do we need to run? So here I have the process for just building from scratch. And kind of one of the ideas of object files is that they should keep us from having to like rebuild everything every time I change one thing in an executable. In particular, you know, if I just change main.c, you know, the code in extra.c didn't change, so we shouldn't need to recompile it. And that, in fact, is true in this case. So if main.c changes, well, we need to rebuild main.o, and we also need to have that be used to actually make the program. So this will be, we'll have to do commands 1 and 3. So questions? How do I figure that out? Yes?
So the first two commands, they create the .o files?
Question, the first two commands create the .o files? Yes. So our first command, this is going to make main.o, and the second one's going to make extra.o. I could have specified explicitly what file they create with the minus O option, but I didn't because the compiler can figure it out based on the input. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so let's do the second part. So if I change extra to H, what commands should I rerun? Question or answer? I'll do show of hands for answers. So, but questions on this, you can check with your neighbors. Okay, so let's do a show of hands for answers. So there's a bunch of, so there's, you know, 0 to 3 commands that need to be run. So who thinks command 1 is one of them? Command 2, one of them. Command 3 is one of them. Okay, so we have probably, it looks like at least a plurality agreeing with what my answer is. So that we need to rerun everything. And why is that? Well, one way I can look at this is I can say, if I look at this sort of diagram I drew, we start at extra.h, and that affects both main.o and extra.o. So both of those are now out of date. If I updated extra.h, that could change the stuff we have to put in main.o and extra.o, potentially. So we have to rebuild those. And when we rebuild one of those, that could change what has to go in program. And so we have to also rebuild program. So we have to run all the commands in that case. So questions on my reasoning for figuring that out? So in this case, it was pretty practical for us to figure out what commands to rerun. But people try to do this sort of thing with a much larger software project. So if, you know, instead of being a C program with, you know, 3 source files, this was, say, Firefox, and I edited one file, one header file, figuring out by hand what to rerun seems like a lot of work. So we want some tools to automate this. And we're going to talk about kind of the oldest tool for automating this, and we'll talk a little bit about sort of more advanced tools at the end, though our lab is going to be used the oldest tool for mining this, which is called Mink. At least one of the oldest tools. Not the oldest, but kind of, you know, the oldest popular one, still common today. And it's for making things by running commands. And it does that this process we just did manually of saying, given what's changed, what commands do I need to run now? So it tries to figure out, you know, what commands need to be run and not run everything all the time. So it's going to try to be smart about, you know, if we only modified main.c, we don't need to remake extra.o. And the way make works is make doesn't actually inherently know sort of how to run the compiler. Instead, you give it rules. And it sort of processes those rules based on when files have been changed. And the rules have this format. So before, we have a name of what's called a target, which is going to be a file we want to generate typically. And that's going to be before a colon. And after a colon, we have a list of its prerequisites, the files that, if they change, we need to regenerate this. So in this case, we're saying that to make main.o, you know, we're going to use main.c, main.h, and extra.h. So if any of them change, main.o could change, so we better rebuild it. And then we have commands to run, which are on some following lines, which are prefixed by a tab character, which I've represented with an arrow. This is a tab character, not just 8 spaces. It has to be an actual tab character. This is one of the unfortunate historical things about Make being from the 70s. And this is just gives us the commands to run. You can have more than one line like this. Here I just have one. And it will run those commands when you ask it for main.o. And commonly we won't just have one rule like this. We could have a bunch of rules. So here I have, say, program. I need main.o and extra.o. And to make extra.o, here are the instructions, and here are the things we need. To make main.o, here are the instructions, here are the things we need. And Make will figure out, if I ask for program, it will sort of go down the chain and say, oh, to make program, I need main.o first. Let's make sure main.o is up to date. Now that main.o is up to date, let's make sure extra.o is up to date. And when I have both of those, then I can do the instructions for program. So it's going to do the prerequisites before it moves on to the commands we say for program, for example. It's going to make main.o and extra.o. It's going to do those commands to build those first. And question?
What happens if you add a prerequisite that isn't really needed?
So question, what happens if I add a prerequisite that isn't really needed? So the Make tool, this is kind of like a mini programming language. So it's not going to check that it's actually used. It's just going to say, well, you told me that, let's say I add some foo.h, I guess I can give an example. So let's say I add some foo.o here that I'm not actually including in the program. It's not going to notice that. It's just going to say, well, if foo.o is modified, I need to rebuild the program. And if foo.o isn't up to date, I need to update it when you ask me to make program. So it's going to sort of use all the prerequisites you use. It's going to check that they're all up to date, regardless of whether they're actually used. And this typically wouldn't be a problem with that O stuff, but if I had an extra.h file here, then it's going to check for that. And if I had one, was missing one, it's not going to know. Because all it does is it looks at this file of rules and processes those. It doesn't look at what your commands are actually doing. It's not that smart. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yes?
Can you run into a situation where there's a deadlock where one file needs another one that hasn't been compiled?
So the question is, what if I have a circular dependency? I believe Make will tell you, I don't know what to do in that case. Yes?
Two rules have prerequisites of each other, would that cause a loop?
Question, two rules that have prerequisites of each other, would that cause a loop? I believe that was the same question you're asking, and I think in that case, Make will tell you, hey, I don't know what to do in this case. Yeah.
It's not a loop, but could there be a bunch of Make files in parallel? Or not parallel, but A dependent on B, B dependent on C?
Can I have A dependent on B, B dependent on C?
Yeah, a chain, yeah.
Absolutely. So here we have kind of a chain. The chain just has 2 links basically, but we can have more steps. So I can make another rule that depends on program, for example. If I wanted to. Yes?
What kind of file is program?
What kind of file is program? So based on the command we're running, I'm running the compiler here with -o and no-c option, and I'm supplying some object files, so you can infer that it's probably an executable file. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yes, back there. Question is, does the order of the rules matter? So, mostly no. And the one exception is, we're going to talk about in the next slide. But other than one thing we're going to mention in the next slide, the order does not matter. Maybe we'll look at what the prerequisites are instead of the order. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so I've shown you what the rules look like. And we're going to put these in a file called makefile, typically with a capital M, all one word, no spaces, no underscores. And then you can run the make utility, and there's various ways you can run it. So one way you can run it is you can type make and the name of a target, so the name of something that's on the left-hand side of that colon that make can build, and make's going to do whatever needs to be done to build that following sort of the chain of prerequisites. So it's going to check that all the prerequisites are built first, and then going to keep going. And if it's already up to date, it's going to do nothing. But if something needs to be done based on what's been modified, it's going to run the commands it needs to run. So it's going to look in the make file, check if the target, you know, is already newer than the prerequisites, and if not. You can also specify multiple targets at once, or you can specify nothing. And if you specify nothing, this is the one case where the order matters, then the first target is the one it's going to build. So other than that, the order doesn't matter, but there's a special rule that the first target is the default. You don't specify any. So that's why in my example I had program first. So if I just type make, it would be the same as typing make program. Okay, so questions? Yes? Question, when I type make, it's looking for the make file in the same directory? Yes. There are ways to make it look in other directories, but we're not going to cover them. You can look it up in the manual. Other questions? Okay, so we've went through kind of the basic operation of make, so let's look at scenario here. Question is, what will make W run? In this scenario, I've told you we have files W, X, Y, Z, and Q. And I'm telling you when they've been modified or one of them, in fact, doesn't exist right now. It's been removed for some reason. And you can check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what you think the answer should be. Okay, who likes more time? Okay, so who thinks A? Okay, B, C, D, okay, E, F, G, no clue. Okay, so most people have an idea, but we don't have consensus on the answer. And one thing about this scenario is that if you look at it carefully, something bad happened in the past. And this scenario looks like something at least very weird happened in the past. Question or?
Yeah, does modified mean compiled, if that makes sense?
Question, does modified mean compiled? So what make is going to look like at is the last modification time, like you would see if you ran, like, used a file browser. And the assumption is that these build commands are going to update that. If they don't, make is not going to behave very well. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
If X and Z exist, how would they have ran or done the very first step? Like, why?
The question, if X and Z exist, why wouldn't Y exist? Which step?
Like the build Y, like the X and Z. I thought that the targets, it'll run if the targets, the prerequisites are there in the target.
So the question is, why are we running? So your assumption is that we're running build Y,
yeah,
based on what other people thought. I haven't actually said what the answer is. We're just assuming everyone's right. Okay. And you're asking, why are we building Y? So let's go through this and what the steps are and what's going on. So I have a graph here of, and this is sort of like just a graphical representation of what those dependencies are. So we have W, which depends on X and Y. So to make sure, to build W, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to make sure X and Y are up to date. So let's think about X. So let's start with Y, just because that's going to make it, that's the our interesting case. Is Y up to date? No, it doesn't exist. It's not up to date. Very trivially. So if something doesn't exist, well, it can't be up to date. It's kind of like it's infinitely old, and we definitely need to make it. Like, run the build command for it. Now, based on W existing now, it sounds like it existed in the past but got removed. So something weird happened here. But that's not a problem. And then to make Y, we're going to say we need X and Z to be up to date first. Z doesn't have any rules, so if it exists, it's there. We don't have any instructions in the make file about what to do about Z, so we're not going to run any commands to update it. For X, we want to check if it's up to date, and we're going to look at the thing it depends on, which is Q. And we find out, oh, wait a moment, X is, in fact, older than Q. So somehow in the past, we made W without updating X, even though it needed to be updated. So something went wrong in the past here. But to fix this situation, we need to rebuild W because it's older than Q, and therefore it doesn't have whatever updates were made in Q incorporated into it, at least potentially. So one command we need to run is build X. And we have to run build X before we can run build Y. Or Y. And we're going to need to run build Y. And after we run build Y, well, Y will end up being more recent than W. And also X will be more recent than W. Because we just made them, and you just ran the command versus, you know, W, which is a minute old. So that after we build X and Y, they'll both be more recent than W, so we need to build W to make W include those changes we just made to X and Y. So we're going to end up running all the commands. So we have E. So we do build X, then build Y, then build W. Yes?
If we were given a build, if any of the options in a build
So the question is, if there was a build queue command, would we run it? So that would depend first on whether the prerequisites of that were newer than queue. If not, or it had no prerequisites, we would do nothing for that. But if so, yes, we'd have to run build queue before we ran build x. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
If y did exist, would the commands change?
Question, if y did exist, would the commands change? So, so someone else want to have a reasoning for that, or? You say it would depend on whether y is less than a minute old or more than a minute old. So you're saying that we have, so you're looking at, you're saying, well, if y existed, whether we need to rebuild it or not for w depends on whether it's older than w. And I agree with that idea. But what's going to end up happening when we try to do this evaluation is when we look at y, we're going to say, oh, we need to make x be up to date. And to make x be up to date, we need a new version of x, and that's going to always end up being newer than however old y was. So because of this dependency between x and q, we always end up rebuilding y. Even if y were, you know, up to date relative to w, we'd still need to. Yes?
So to clarify, if q was like 4 hours old, would that mean that we still rerun build x, or we don't rerun?
Question, if Q was 4 hours old, would we not build X? And the answer is that's correct. You know, so if Q was 4 hours old, then X is up to date, and we don't need to rebuild it. Okay. Other questions? Comments? Yeah.
Does it matter if you look at X or Y first?
No. So I went through the scenario sort of writing on the slide, looking at Y first and then X, but we'll come to the same conclusion either way. If we look at X first, well, we'll rebuild it first. If we look at Y first, well, we'll have to go to X and we'll build it first. Now, there is some, in a more complicated make file, there might be sort of choices on what to build first that are both correct for the make to do. In this example, there is not. Okay, other questions? Yeah. Yes.
If Y did exist and it wasn't modified, do we still need to rebuild X because it is older?
Question, if Y did exist, would we still need to rebuild X? Yes. Yeah. Because we're always going to check all the prerequisites are up to date, regardless of sort of whether the immediate thing is up to date. So that's for example, why even if we started with, even if Y wasn't involved, we still have to rebuild X in this case, because we look at W, we'd say, to build W, we need to make sure X is ready, and we found out X isn't ready, and have to remake it. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Sauce, thunder sauce. Yeah.
And then, if I'm understanding it correctly, the command will, or the rule will only be run if the prerequisites are younger than the target file.
Question, the rule will only be run if the prerequisites are younger than the target file? That is, yeah, that is correct. Yes, back there.
Sorry, if you're running build X, does that not make X less recent than W?
Question, if you're running build X, does that not make X less recent than W? The assumption that make has is that all these build commands are going to make the file they generate be modified 0 minutes ago. Build Y if less recent?
Build W if less recent than X.
Oh, yes, it would be. So I'm sorry. Yeah. This is an error on the slide. Correct, yes. Yes, both X and Y would have been updated before we look at whether W needs to be built, so they'll both be more recent and tell us we need to rebuild W. Okay, other questions? Yes.
Is that or like a short circuit? Will it just just build W and stop if X, if it's less recent than X?
Question is at or short circuit. I wouldn't say it's noted. I wouldn't know how you know if it's short circuit, but it's going to. But if anything, any of them are more recent, we have to run the command for W. And before we do that, we're going to go through the whole process of checking all the prerequisites. Yes. Question, does the order of the rules in the makefile matters? Basically, no. Except for that special case of the default is the first rule.
What if, like, does it, like, affect, I guess, performance? If you have, like, a bunch of...
Question, does it affect performance? So the order of your prerequisites or rules could perhaps affect how make decides what to build first in the case of ties. In the case, like, both are options. But other than that, it shouldn't. Question, make us depending on the timestamps of the file? Yes. Yes, that is the primary way it works. Okay, so we talked about sort of the mechanics of building things. So far I've shown us having make targets, which are actual files. If you look at make files in the real world, you'll often see targets that are not files. So for example, a common thing to do because the first target is default, is to have a target called all that just depends on files you want to generate. But the intention of this is to make like it so you can type make all instead of make program one, program two, and lib foo.a to build sort of all the things that the make file handles. But the idea is not actually to build a file called all. And this idea is used really commonly, and it mostly just works. Because when you ask make to make all, it's going to say, well, that file doesn't exist. Let's run all the commands for its prerequisites. And then let's run the commands to build it. Oh, there's none of them. Done. So it just works. But there's a bit of a problem with this. And you'll see. And I guess there's some other, I'll give another example first of a common example of this. Another common sort of what I'll call a phony target is something called clean, that you want just a kind of quick command to type to remove generated files to force everything to be rebuilt. So if you're worried that your make rules, you know, are wrong, or maybe you like you modified files because like you copied them over so the modification times don't make sense, you might have a command like this to just clear out everything and so when you try again, it will, you know, have to make the .o files again. This case. This is a common target you'll see in make files other people write. But in this case, again, the intention here is not to have a file called clean. The intention here is kind of to make clean a convenient command you can run. And a problem with this is, let's say I make a file called all or a file called clean. Well, then potentially make could say, oh, well, that file called, so for the most part, it's probably not an issue, right, if I make a file called all, because, you know, at least it's going to rebuild program one, program two, and lib3. But for a file called clean, that kind of doesn't work out very well. Because if I make a file called clean, it's going to say, oh, yep, the file called clean you made, that's newer than the files clean depends on, which is none. And it's there, don't need to do anything. And your make clean command will end up doing nothing. So that's kind of inconvenient. So to support this, make has this way of marking rules as what GNU makes manual called phony, which says, hey, these things aren't real files, don't check modification times for them. Don't look for them existing. These are just, you know, targets that, you know, don't correspond to real files, but they're still commands I want you to run. So in this case, every time I want to make clean, I don't want you to check for a file called clean, I just want you to run the build command for clean. And for all, I don't want you to check for a file called all, just make sure the prerequisites are there and up to date. So questions on these phony targets?
So when you, if you don't have the dot for me rule, when you run the make clean and make all, is that actually something that's going to be created?
The question, when I, if I don't have the phony rule, will something be created when I want to make clean and make all? No. And the reason why is the commands I've given for building all and clean don't create that file. But it's going to check for that file, and if you create a file called clean, for example, it's going to say, oh, there's a file called clean, I don't need to run this rm command. Which probably isn't what the person who wrote that clean rule intended. Other questions? The question, the dot phony is actually a rule. So it's a very, is a special kind of rule that doesn't, the rules starting with dot that make supports are not normal rules. They're basically just ways of marking other rules with for make. Does that answer your question? Okay, yes.
When you have like some kind of macro like clean, can you like do multiple tabs to do multiple?
The question is, can I have multiple commands in here? Absolutely. So I could have another line starting with a tab and another, you know, command. That'd be perfectly fine. And all of that would be the instructions for clean. Does that answer your question?
Are they guaranteed to be in sequential order?
Are they guaranteed to be in sequential order? Yes. Other questions? Yeah.
Why can't you make these?
What?
Why can't you like use the same like main clean and make all?
What do you mean, why can't you use make clean and make all?
Why do you need the phony?
Why do I need the phony? So it will mostly work without that. The issue is that for a rule like clean, make is going to behave differently if you create a file called clean kind of by accident. And dot phony will prevent that from happening. Yeah. Would I create three different make files?
One for clean, one for all.
So the scenario I have here is that I have one make file for usually a whole directory, and I have an all and a clean target in it. So I could go to that directory, I could type make all to build, in this case, program one, program two. I could type make clean to run the clean command. And I could like type make program two to just make program two. And the make file would have rules for all clean, program one, program two. I've only showed a subset of the rules here. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yes, back there.
Sorry, what does the dash dash force do?
What does dash dash force do? That tells RM not to complain if the files don't exist. Okay. It also tells RM to ignore some types of errors that it normally wouldn't ignore to. Yes, back there.
If you don't have permission for files, can you make, like, abide by that?
If I don't have permission for files, will make abide by that? So make will run the commands you specify. And whatever those commands do when you don't have permission is what's going to happen. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So we saw some conventional targets. So, and you might see if you look up, like, programs you can find online, you might find there's a bunch of other conventional targets. Make install is another one that like copies the files to some location that you might, you know, install them at, or make test to run tests, things you might see. Now, one thing that we've seen in make so far is that it sounds like what I told you, writing make files seems a little redundant. You know, I have extra white space here. Just pretend that there's no space here. But it seems a little redundant because, you know, I'm typing the name of my compiler, and let's say I want to run clang with dash wo, which you should be doing all the time. Please. Yeah. Or I want to change from clang to GCC. With this make file, I have to edit a whole bunch of places to add that or change that. And that seems rather inconvenient, and this is like a really small toy example. If I have like a program with 20 source files, it seems like an awful lot of work. So there are ways that make has of sort of saving this typing. So one is what are called variables, or sometimes macros. that we can kind of define these things at the top of our file for setting that we just want to include in our commands or in our prerequisites and use them later. And the syntax, we define them with equals, or you might also see colon equals, both work. They're slightly different in some way that's not relevant for us. And then we can use them with this dollar and parentheses syntax elsewhere in the make file. Here I've only shown them in the commands. We could also use them in the prerequisites list. So we could like have a list of H files and include that in all the .io rules. So this saves some typing here, and this makes it so, you know, I have one place I can edit, add wall and so on to my clang command, or change my clang command to GCC, or back and forth as I want, and so on. So questions about these variables? Yes?
Are these conventions or actual?
Are these conventions? So the names I have chosen are conventions. It turns out that make has some rules built in, which you might mention later, which use particular variables, which make them a little more than conventions, but for the most part, these are just conventional names I have chosen that you will see very commonly. Other questions? Yeah?
What is dash
wall? What is dash wall? That turns on most warnings. You think all warnings, because that's what the ALL is, but most warnings. Yes?
What does dash pedantic do?
It turns on, it makes, it adheres stricter to the language spec in certain ways. Okay. Other questions? Yes?
Why would you use a variable for some like lib if it's like dash lm?
Why do we use a variable if it's only like dash lm? So, probably the reason why is if we were making multiple programs, that would give us one place where we could change sort of how we link all the programs. So I found out, I actually need to use LM and LRT, I can change it for all of them in one place. Or I don't need LM, I can change it for all of them in one place. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? So we still have a bunch of redundancy here in that for all these rules, I'm typing like program twice, I'm typing the .o files twice, I'm typing the C file names twice, and so on. Can I avoid that? And there is a way to do that. So there are other special variables which have names that I have to look up every time that in commands refer to things in the rule that was used to make it. So our ampersand here is, dollar at, that's not an ampersand, is always the name of the target of the rule we're in, and dollar less than sign is always the name of the first prerequisite. So in this case, extra.c, in this next case, extra main.c, and dollar up caret is always the list name of all the prerequisites of the rule, so in this case main.o and extra.o. So this is a way I can avoid typing things multiple times. Yes?
What is the dollar at sign?
The dollar at sign refers to the target of the rule. So in this case, it refers to program, and then extra.o rule, it refers to extra.o, and so on. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yes?
Can you index like a specific prerequisite?
Can I index a specific prerequisite? Maybe, or probably, but I don't know how. It might involve something ugly, but probably. Yes?
What's the difference between the caret
and the less than? The caret is all the prerequisites. The less than is only the first one. So I'm not supplying the names of the .h files to clang in this example, but I am supplying all the .o files to clang for the first rule. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? So here we still have a bunch of redundancy in that I'm writing a whole bunch of rules for that basically say the same thing for my .o and .c files. So we can simplify that too. So we can make sort of rules that specify a pattern. And there's two ways of doing this. I'm going to first show you the oldest way called suffix rules, where I have this special rule .c.o, and it doesn't say to make a file that starts with a dot. It actually says to turn any .c file into a .o file, do this. And I can just specify that once, and then I just specify the prerequisites for the .o files. And it's going to use those commands I specified elsewhere, commands I specify for .c.o. Questions? And I guess you can see to use this, we kind of really needed these variables to specify, so we don't have to, you know, figure out, because we need to figure out, you know, the .o file name and the command needs to be different every time. So this is the older way of doing it, and there's also a newer syntax, which I find more intuitive, but is less portable. But this will work on Linux. If you're on, like, FreeBSD or things like that, you might have problems. Yeah.
What was that replacing?
What is this replacing? So in the previous example, for each .o file, we needed to have a separate command. Here, I have one command, and it's applied to all the .o files. And we can also do this with this other syntax, which I find more intuitive, where we specify kind of a percent sign representing something that's the same on either side of the colon. Yes?
So in the first example...
I'll start down here. Then.
So since there are no prerequisites anymore, what is the dollar sign thing represented?
Question, since there's no prerequisites anymore, so this rule implicitly has a... implicitly is... anything dot O colon anything dot C. So it's dollar and sign, so that's what it sort of expands into. So the dollar at sign is going to be the anything dot O, and the first prerequisite is going to be the anything dot C. And the same is true with this other syntax. It's probably clearer with this other syntax that it works that way, because this was designed after the first one, they realized it was kind of intuitive. And back there, question? Okay. Yes?
So you don't understand make extra, and then it goes back to the
so I run the command make.
Because like, on the bottom has the extra
dot. Oh, question is, like, how do these work? So make will look for, if you have multiple rules with the same target, make's going to sort of combine them. And that works to our advantage here. So even though this rule only specifies that extra.c is a prerequisite of extra.o, this rule says extra.h also is, and it's going to sort of take merge them together. Yes?
How does the make file know whether to choose extra.o and main.o for the thing it read?
How does it know whether to choose between extra.o or main.o and the thing I read? This is a pattern rule, so it's going to apply to both of them. So it's going to apply any time it wants something.o, it's going to look for something.c, no matter what the something is. Does that answer your question? Yes?
Because you use dollar sign less than, does that mean it's not going to look at extra.h or main.h?
Your question, because I use dollar sign less than, does it mean it's not going to look at extra.h? It's going to look at it because it's going to have to say, let's check if extra.h is up to date and all that. But it's not going to be included in the command we run, because this thing after the tab here, that's just a command. So the command's not going to have extra.h. We're just going to tell Clang about extra.c and have it figure out that extra.h is involved. Does that answer your question? Yes, back there. So the question is, could you add %.o %.h or something, or like %.h on the .o line? Is that what you're asking? I believe you can, yes. And it will apply that for everything. It won't apply, so note that the percent has to be the same everywhere in the pattern. So It's only going to look for, if I have main.o, it's going to look for main.h if I specify that. Other questions? Okay. And so someone asked earlier, are these names I've chosen, CC, C flags, and so on, are they kind of just convention? And I said mostly, but not entirely. And the reason why not entirely is that a rule like this is actually built into most versions of make. And that means I can just write this make file, and it already has that rule for me, so I don't need to write it myself. Okay, questions? Yeah. Question, that would be implicit for the extra target and main.o target? Yes, because I haven't specified any commands. It's going to look for a rule with commands, is my understanding. Usually I recommend writing it explicitly, but I'm mentioning this because you might wonder, why does this work? Well, that's why. Yeah?
Can you highlight like exactly what is being excluded with this implicit
multiple rule? The thing I have brackets around here. That's what's being excluded. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
OK. Other questions? OK, so some last thoughts on make files. So here, we had to specify like all the .h dependencies. That's actually pretty error-prone. And commonly, sort of more modern approaches automate this. And there's some ways of doing that with make. So one way of doing it with make is that GCC and Clang, if you pass dash capital M, instead of compiling, they'll output a make rule. They'll like figure out what it includes and give you a make rule that is like main.o colon main.h and so on. There are also a bunch of programs which generate make files. So commonly, especially for very large software projects, it's common for people not to write the make files by hand, but to have a program that writes make files. And there are also, so in addition to programs that write make files, there are other build systems that usually kind of work like make. They have to do this process where they like have some rules. They're either like written in some input file, or maybe they're implicit, like they know .o files are made from .c files, and they just have that built in, like make kind of does. But they sort of follow the same idea that they're going to like look at when things were changed and try to rebuild only what needs to be rebuilt. So there's a whole bunch of them out there that you might see. So I mentioned here Ninja, Scons, Bazel, Maven, Xcode build, which is the build command that's usually used in Xcode, or MSBuild, which is the build command usually used in Visual Studio, are all examples of these kind of things. They probably work similar to make, but they have different ways of writing rules, different things built in. But kind of the basic way they work is similar. And there's also tools that kind of generate inputs for make or similar systems, just to automate writing those rules, or to support like writing multiple versions of those rules for like different platforms. Okay. Some questions? Yes.
What's the difference between a compiler like Clang and a make tool?
What's the difference between the compiler and the make tool? So the compiler is just, yeah, generally. Most compilers, there might be exceptions for some other languages, but most compilers are just going to produce an assembly or .o file from what you tell it, and they aren't going to like check whether things are up to date. So the whole thing about make is that make is just about how do I know how many times to run the compiler or anything else I need to run. That's make's job. Make doesn't actually understand like what's in C files. All it knows is how to do is run the compiler or similar things. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so I expected this topic to go quicker, but that's fine, first time teaching this. So let's talk about our next topic, which is going to be about operating systems. And we're going to start with a motivation of things that if you SSH into Portal, that your program shouldn't be able to do. And we're going to talk about well, how is it not possible for your programs to do these things? What is actually going on in the system and the hardware to make that happen? The first thing we're going to talk about is, why can't you just read other people's files? So what's stopping that? And sort of the answer from the hardware perspective is, well, you know, there's some instructions you can run on the machine that will read files. Like, there's like a hard drive or something like that, and there are instructions to access it. So why can't you just write a program that contains those instructions? And the answer is that, well, there are instructions that are marked considered privileged. So we don't just let any program do all the instructions. There's some instructions that we're just going to disable when normal programs are running. So for example, the instructions that are going to talk to a hard drive, those are going to be these privileged instructions. You can't actually put them in your program and run them, and if you try, it's not going to work. And what's going to happen is our processor is going to have two modes that it's going to run in. There's going to be something we'll call kernel mode, where those privileged instructions are going to be allowed, and user mode, where they aren't. And the hope is that only trusted code that the operating system writes is going to run in kernel mode. And that code is going to check things like, are you actually allowed to access the file that we're reading from the disk? And because you have to go through that code, that's going to be the only way that you can access files, so you won't have a way of accessing the wrong files. And kind of the hardware implementation is basically that there's like a 1-bit register, which is already in kernel mode. A bunch of instructions use that register. And whenever you run the OS, we switch to kernel mode. And whenever we're done running the OS, we're going to somehow switch back to normal mode. We'll talk about what the mechanism for doing that looks like because, well, the normal thing doesn't work. We're going to talk about one version of it just next. So a problem you might have with this is that, you know, how are we going to do that? And in particular, we think of the OS, like the OS probably has a function to read from the disk that's going to use some privileged instructions. And it has the function we're supposed to call for reading a file. And a question we might have is, what's stopping me from calling read from disk into directly if I can call this read file function, that the one that actually checks whether I'm allowed to read the file? Why can't I just skip over and call the OS code directly that reads from the disk and doesn't check that? And the answer is that we're only going to allow entry into kernel mode using a controlled way. And the way we're going to use for requests like reading a file is something we're going to call a system call. And there's going to be a special instruction to make a system call. And it's going to start the OS, but it's not going to start it at an arbitrary location. We aren't going to be able to just call this read from disk into function. Instead, it's going to go to a location the OS specified at boot. And that's the only place we're going to be able to call. So we're not going to be able to run arbitrary functions in the OS. We have the syscall instruction, and it runs what we'll call the system call handler, which is the OS specifies at boot, and that's the only place it can go. So the code at this location, that system call handler, it's going to figure out what we want to do, but it's going to do it in a way where it's going to know that this is code for, you know, that's being called by an external a program that we might not want to allow to do certain things, and it's going to filter out those requests. It's going to say, oh, you want to read a file? I'm going to check the file first. And we're not going to be able to skip that because this is the only place way we can call the code that reads the file. We can't run code in that special mode that can access the disk without going through this special routine. And this routine always, always checks first if we're allowed to do it. So let's look at how this looks on Linux, sort of as an example. So there's a special instruction called syscall, and it runs OS code that the OS specified at boot in kernel mode. And Linux has a calling convention for system calls. So just like with function calls, we have to decide, when you call a function, how does the function know what I want it to do? And to make that decision, we said, oh, there's certain places I put arguments to the function, and when the function is done, there's a certain place it puts a return value. We make the same decisions for these system calls. And what Linux has chosen for those decisions is basically the same as function calls with one addition here. And that big addition here is that we have to specify what operation we want to do. And what Linux has chosen is that the register REX specifies that. And we need this because when we make a system call, it goes to one place. But we might want to open a file. We might want to exit. We might want to print something to the screen. We have all these different operations we want to do, but they all go to one place. We need to specify which operation are we doing. When we make a function call, we kind of specify that by which function we call. But here, there's only one place to go. So in place of like what function we call, we set REX to an identifier that the OS will check to figure out what operation are you asking me to do. Otherwise, this actually looks pretty much like a normal function call. So let's show you some code that prints hello world with system calls in Linux. So here, it doesn't start at main, it starts at underscore start. So remember when I talked about the compiler linking in extra files to make your program? And those are called main. So here, this is a program that's built to not even use libc. So it doesn't have anything calling, it doesn't have main. It's in fact just starting at start. There's nothing that calls start. It's actually the starting point, and it doesn't use the C library. So what we do here is, in the calling convention, remember, we had our system call number. So it turns out the number 1 identifies a system call for writing somewhere. And I specify where I want to write. I use the number 1 to specify I want to write to my standard out. And I put a pointer to the string I want to write, and the length of the string, and the other arguments, and then I run syscall. And that's going to run some code that's going to say, oh, here it's going to say, oh, if rax equals equals 1, you know, do write. And it's going to track, you know, internally in the kernel, it's going to have something that checks if rax is 1, and if so, it's going to do the write operation. And after that, it returns, and I make another system call. And my other system call, in this case, I specify operation number 60, which is the operation for exit. I need a system call to do that because, well, if I just return here, nothing called this. This is just where it started. There's nothing to return to. So I need to ask the operating system to help me, please, I want this program to go away. So I use the exit system call to do that. And I pass 0 as my value to exit with, just like when you call the exit function in C, you have to pass a number. Some questions on my assembly code here? Yeah?
So the RDI and RDX, they are the arguments for the system call?
The question, RDI and RDX are arguments? RDI, RSI, and RDX are arguments. The calling convention is basically the same as the normal function calling convention, except REX specifies what operation. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? So, yes?
What happens when there's no exit call?
What happens when there's no exit call? So if I just returned, then there's no value on the stack for that was put there. So I try to pop something from the stack and get some garbage address and try to jump there, and my program would segfault. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, and yeah, so that's our system call. And there's lots of different system call operations, some of which you've used through a C wrapper. So for example, I think you've used socket before, and that on Linux, there's a system call that corresponds directly to that C function you called. So something to note is that to make a system call, I need to run the syscall instruction. There's not actually a way of writing that in C, but often we want to write C programs that kind of directly make system calls. So commonly what we'll do is we'll have a system call wrapper. So For example, this C library on Linux defines a function called open. And all open does is it sets the operation to number 2, which is open, and runs syscall. And then it does a little bit of work to deal with the return value. But basically what it's doing is running, is telling the kernel, this is an open, and then passing the arguments you pass to open to syscall. And when you call this later on, you'll just call it like a C function. And this is kind of just exists because I can't actually write syscall in C. There's no way of doing that. But I can write a function called this little assembly function. So there's lots of functions in the standard library that you, including some you've used, like socket, that they're just basically something that is a little bit of assembly that just sets REX and makes a syscall. So questions on our system call wrapper? Okay. And if you want to see what's going on with syscalls, you can use a tool like, on Linux, there's a tool called strace. And this is a debugging tool that will just run a program and dump every system call it makes to, by default, your terminal, or in this example, to a text file. So you can see I ran my Hello World program, and I have these 3 system calls it makes. The first one I didn't make, but the shell made to run the program. That's what that execv is. We'll talk about that much later in the semester. And then I have the write I made and the exit. So this is kind of a debugging tool. And you might say, okay, well, this was sort of a very trivial program. We could also look at what happens with a program that's like written in C instead of assembly. So here I use puts, and I have a few extra calls here. You might say, what's going on? But ultimately, it ends up making a write system call. So puts is implemented using write. There's just a bunch of other stuff going on too. You might say, what is all this? So we have the execve. These brk calls are allocating memory. So because we're using the C-standard library, it needs to allocate some stuff. So it calls this allocating memory thing. There's stuff related to threading, which is a topic we'll talk about later, supporting having your program do multiple things. There's some stuff where the C library is like looking up what type of system are we on, what's the name of this program, can I access some files, like this configuration file here for the C-standard library. So it does a bit of extra work, but we can kind of see these are all the requests the program is making to the system. Okay, some questions. So we can look at happens. So we can use this to like examine how the program is interacting with this sort of privileged part of the system. And we can see that, yes, kind of unfortunately, just using the C standard library adds a lot of extra stuff to our program startup. And this is a statically linked program. So if we do a dynamically linked program, we'll notice, as I mentioned when I talked about dynamic linking, one of the things it does is open up the libc. And actually read from it and load it into the program. Questions about our system calls? Yes. Question, are syscall functions like privileged? Or so I guess the way we can look at it is like the system call implementation, the thing that running syscall runs in kernel mode, that runs in kernel mode, so it has access to extra instructions. So we can kind of say that our applications, like our interface to the machine, is we have sort of our user mode instructions, the ones that just work in our normal user mode, like move and add. And we have this system call interface, which goes through this piece of code that runs in kernel mode, which we'll call the kernel, and it can use the complete hardware interface for us. And perhaps more commonly, we're not going to actually kind of use that system call interface directly, but we're going to go through some library interface, like putS or printf, and so, or system call wrappers, like you saw there. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah?
How do they know if one's code is trusted? Like, any code can just use...
Question, how do we know if one code is trusted? So let's talk about the word trusted versus trustworthy. So I say the operating system code is trusted because we allow it to do whatever it wants to do when it's running in kernel mode. Whether it's trustworthy, whether we should actually be letting it do that, that is a different question we are not answering at this time. Our hope is that it is trustworthy, that the thing that this running, that the system call handler runs, that code that like checks, are you allowed to open this file, is correct, you know, and does what we want, but that's not a property we're talking about how we guarantee that yet. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yeah.
How is the kernel different from the OS?
How is the kernel different from the OS? So I kind of have sort of a more picture of a classic Unix design. This is a little complicated here. So we have like our applications, and we have like the standard libraries. We also have a bunch of standard utility programs, right? Like the program you log into, and the shell, and so on. And a lot of these things, they run in user mode. They don't run in kernel mode. And the kernel is the name we give for the part that runs with that kernel node where it has complete access to the hardware. So that's the kernel. The OS, well, it depends who you talk to. Some people will say, all our standard libraries, all our standard utility programs, that's the OS. Some people will say, just the kernel part's the OS. Some people will say, maybe it's something in between. Some of the utilities are part of the OS and some aren't. That term is not super well defined, and I'm going to avoid like relying on a precise definition for that reason. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. Yes. Question, what is read-only and the other one? The other one is close on exec, which will make sense when we talk about exec in several months. Okay, other questions? Okay, so I have a minute. Let me use my minute. So we have two other categories of things we want to talk. We're going to talk about how that the kernel is going to provide. So one is, we're going to have to keep programs from modifying memory they're not supposed to. We've kind of alluded to the mechanism for that, which is this idea of address translation. And the other thing is that, well, if our programs are running on the processor, why can't they just hang the system? And the mechanism for that is that just like the OS has a special code that runs for system calls, it's going to turn out that there's this more general idea called exceptions, which is different than the exceptions you see in Java, called hardware exceptions, where not only does a specified piece of OS code run when there's a request from a program, but it also runs when there's requests from the hardware. So for example, when a key press comes in, or a network packet comes in, or a timer goes off. And that's going to be why you can't like write an infinite loop and hang portal. So those are the things we'll talk about next time. And remember, there's a lab tomorrow on Make. So make sure you do it.